You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, October 3rd, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Donald Iacovone, author of Teaching White Supremacy, the textbook battle over race in American history. Meanwhile, Bolsonaro and Lula are headed to a runoff after Lula finished in first, but not by enough. Bolsonaro outperformed polling, and Lula did not reach the 50% necessary, so now a second round will be held on October 30th. A new Supreme Court term begins today, and they will hear cases targeting affirmative action, voting, public assistance programs, and more. It looks bleak, but the historic part is still real. Today will be Ketanji Brown Jackson's first official day on the job. The death toll from Hurricane Ian is at least 83 people in Florida, 4 in North Carolina. Puerto Rico is also still recovering from Hurricane Fiona, right? Fiona? A few weeks back. Hard to keep track because there's so many. At least 25 people died in Puerto Rico. After the Senate passed the continuing resolution to keep the government funded through mid-December, without the Manchin rioter, but with the $12 billion for Ukraine, the House passed it too, and Biden signed it quickly afterwards. So, no government shutdown for now. The mystery around who Perla is, the woman who coaxed migrants from San Antonio onto a plane to Martha's Vineyard for DeSantis' political stunt with Florida taxpayer money, is becoming clearer. She's reportedly, and honestly, the story could not get more ridiculous if we tried, an apt for our purposes, a counterintelligence agent who spent two decades in the Army.
Whose actual name is Perla?
Yeah, she's a good secret agent when she uses her real freaking name.
She missed that day of counterintelligence school.
Polls are tightening in the Fetterman and Oz race, frighteningly enough. An average of polling has Fetterman's lead down from 9 to 4 points. Keep the pressure on, please. Also in Pennsylvania, Republican state lawmakers are trying to impeach Larry Krasner because of crime. Not a crime he committed, just crime. This is the Chesa Boudin model.
Yep.
Anti-government protests in Iran sparked by the police killing of Mahsa Amini have reached their 16th consecutive day. Videos from Tehran show security forces using tear gas and other violence against student protesters, which has been a theme in these demonstrations where dozens have been killed. Ukraine has submitted an application to join NATO, which is unlikely to happen right now because they're in the middle of a war, but something to note. And lastly, the second military coup in a year has occurred in Burkina Faso. Thinking of all of the people experiencing that instability and violence. All this and more on today's program. Yes, my name is Emma. No, it is not Sam Steeder.
Doesn't look like Sam Steeder.
It's not me, even though I know the signs can sometimes confuse some people. Maybe you have that thing that Brad Pitt says he has where you can't remember human faces, which is, I don't know, interesting. But Sam is called in sick this morning. He's not feeling great. So hoping he's okay. He says he tested negative this morning, but he's definitely feeling pretty sick. We spoke to him on the phone, and he sounded it. So hope he's okay. There's a lot going around right now. My partner has COVID. I've been, having to mask in all common areas and confined to certain spaces of the apartment. people are either sick with something or sick with COVID. That's basically like half the people in my life right now.
Yeah, well,
so
feel better because the pandemic is over, so it's not so bad.
That's what Biden said.
Yeah.
I did hear that on the news one time. But yeah, hoping Sam feels better and hope he can join us at some point, maybe tomorrow or later in the week. Let's talk about Brazil. We're going to have a guest on to dive a bit deeper into this, which I like to do since Brazil is not the country that I live in, so my knowledge is not as strong there. But I have been following it for a while, much because of this show and Michael's emphasis on this, and also just because this could not be a more important election in for the world and for Brazil, of course. So yesterday, Lula received just under the 50% he would have needed to avoid a runoff. He got 48.4% to Bolsonaro's 43.2% around, and a great majority of the ballots have been counted, over 99%. So this is likely to hold. He would have needed, as I said, to exceed 50% to be elected in the first round. So now this runoff for a country of over 200 million people is going to happen on October 30th. And this election could not have higher stakes. The Amazon rainforest could turn into a savanna if it continues on this trajectory. It's necessary to absorb carbon as we look down the barrel of the effects of climate change. And under Bolsonaro's leadership, the CO2 emissions doubled in 2019 and 2020 before he was elected. And so his support for illegal logging in the Amazon has been disastrous, to say the least, let alone his suppression of political opposition, his treatment of indigenous people throughout the country. And another reason this would be significant, too, is, one, it would show an opposition to the kind of election denialism that we're seeing in the U.S. Bolsonaro has been flirting with a coup for months at this point, if not years, has said that he will, if he loses, it's probably fraudulent. If he wins, it's not. Does that sound familiar? And you have people like Steve Bannon echoing that as well, because as we discussed with Ruth Ben-Ghiat last week, fascism is international in nature, and all of these far right wingers are taking clues from one another. But here is Lula before, or right after, actually, I should say, casting his ballot for himself for president. And I will speak over this if you're listening on the podcast, because there are subtitles, but he's obviously not speaking in English. So hit play, Bradley, if you could. It's more than an important day for me. I can't go without mentioning to you that 4 years ago I couldn't vote because I had been the victim of a lie in this country. I was detained at the federal police exactly on election day. I tried to get the ballot box to go to my cell to vote. They didn't. And 4 years later, I'm here voting with the recognition of my total freedom and with the possibility of becoming president of this country again, to try to get the country back to normality. And yes, also the important element to this story was Lula was a political prisoner, locked up under fraudulent and corrupt circumstances to suppress him because of the threat of his social democratic policies on a lot of powerful people in that country. And yeah, Bolsonaro, I understand he's distasteful, much like Trump is, to business interests in the United States, but they'd much rather have that kind of far right wing fascist than they would have Lula back into power.
I mean, you see even The Economist, like papers like that, play a little bit of footsie with Bolsonaro, so they like the extraction that Bolsonaro is able to facilitate. And the outcome, I think a lot of people were hoping for Lula to win in round one, just not have to do a runoff. I think probably would have, like, honestly saved lives, because this could get ugly the way Bolsonaro supporters are. But I guess there's going to have to be a runoff, and that's disappointing. And it also looks like Bolsonaro's party increased their membership in the Congress, which is going to make it tough for Lula to govern, assuming he does win the runoff. And but I would also follow at Vincent Bevins. That's Vincent with two N's. He's a good journalist. Says that, you know, that's also not par for the course for Brazilian politics. So we'll see. But not a horrible outcome, but not the exciting celebratory outcome that I think a lot of people were hoping for.
I mean, he came close, and it would have been nice to have this over with so we don't have to deal with this going into October 30th. But Lula was saying, you know, hey, I know a lot of people would want me to stop campaigning, but I'm down. Like, I'm ready. Let's go. And so that's always been seemingly his attitude towards this. Seems like there should be another debate or a debate between them. I'm not clear if that was just the way it was translated or if that's the case. But so a few more weeks of campaigning. This could not be more important, as I mentioned, for not just Brazil, but just for the future of the planet, given the way that Brazil is placed in terms of preventing catastrophic climate events because of the Amazon rainforest and the trajectory that it's on right now.
As well as like just like the political struggles that are going on. It's a very big difference when other countries are trying to elect leftists and, you know, work towards socialism to have Lula in power in Brazil compared to Bolsonaro.
Yeah, and it would be this capstone on this incredible movement over the past few years of left-wing governments across Latin America getting elected in response to what was a previous resurgence of far-right governments in Latin America getting elected. Like, we're seeing this now in Colombia and in Bolivia and, you know, in Mexico to a degree, a center-left, lefty president as well. So to have Brazil, the largest country in Latin America, have Lula come back into power, again, you can't overstate the significance of that.
And I'm getting a correction. It's a technically second round of elections, not a runoff from Cass Moons.
Oh, yes. Yes. With that said, we are going to soon head to our guest, Donald Iacovone. But first, we have a message from our sponsors. Now, I don't know if you've heard of Ritual before, but I have. And I try to keep up on my vitamins, but I'm very bad at it and I forget about it. I know Sam is a huge fan of this sponsor, and it keeps him healthy with the vitamins that he needs because he's old. I'm joking. But this is really for everybody because you need to, you know, keep yourself healthy. And I need to get better at that, honestly. I need to use Ritual more. Ritual is a company that was founded by a skeptical mom who didn't trust the multivitamins out there. I know there's a lot of candy gunk out there. Today, Ritual has a first-of-its-kind traceable supply chain so you can see where all of your key ingredients come from and why they are there. Their flagship multi has USP verification and peer-reviewed and published clinical study. Plus, all of Ritual's products are vegan and non-GMO and third-party tested, so you know that you can trust them. Ritual's multivitamins are specifically formulated to help fill nutrient gaps in the diet with key ingredients like vitamin D3 and vegan omega-3 DHA. Their delayed response capsule is designed to be gentle on the stomach. That's good because sometimes when I take my vitamins on an empty stomach, it can mess me up. But these delayed release capsules are always helpful. And there's a mint tab in every bottle to keep things fresh. Ritual is a certified B Corporation that believes doing good for your health means doing good for the planet. It's delivered straight to your door each month, so you never have to worry about running out. Plus, it's also easy to snooze when you need to. That's really the part that just is, I think, so key here, is having it delivered to your door so you have no excuse to forget when your bottle runs out. Start a vitamin ritual that you can trust. To get started, visit ritual.com/majority today and get 10% off your first three orders. That's ritual.com/majority to start your new ritual today. ritual.com/majority. Now, another word from another one of our sponsors. This really has changed my entire sleeping experience, Cozy Earth. Remember the last time you had two great nights sleep in a row? Still thinking? Not for me, because I have Cozy Earth. Get ready to sleep like a baby every night with Cozy Earth sheets. Cozy Earth was created to enhance people's lives by offering the softest, most luxurious, and environmentally friendly bedding in the world. With over 5,000 five-star reviews, Cozy Earth has never wavered on that promise. Cozy Earth sheets are made from premium 100% viscose from bamboo, which means they're super soft, lightweight, and temperature regulating, so you sleep more comfortably year-round. The temperature regulating part is key. I have the duvet, so I have the comforter, and then there's a duvet cover that comes on top. And I'm, like, even with the air conditioning on, my AC unit's pretty bad, but I sleep really, really hot, and I can't stand it, and it will keep me tossing and turning at night if a blanket is too heavy. But this really solved that problem for me. I'm being fully honest about that. Cozy Earth bamboo sheets are now available in four natural colors and even come packaged in a stylish, reusable Cozy Earth tote. Whether it's their best-selling luxury sheets, ultra-comfortable loungewear collection, which I gotta check out, or new bath collection, you'll absolutely love shopping at Cozy Earth. Get cozy now. My audience can save 35% on Cozy Earth. Go to CozyEarth.com/majority to save 35%, all backed by a 100-night sleep guarantee. That's CozyEarth.com/majority. CozyEarth.com/majority. And lastly, oh boy. Isn't it crazy that in 2022 we have high-speed internet, celebrities going to space, and electric cars, and yet people are still cleaning their bums the way our Victorian brothers and sisters did with toilet paper? Step into the 21st century and upgrade your bathroom routine and start washing your bum with Hello Tushy bidets because smearing your business around with toilet paper is so 100 years ago. The Hello Tushy bidet attachment washes your bum with fresh water for a way better clean than toilet paper. Simply spray and pat dry. It attaches to your existing toilet. No electrician or plumber needed. It installs in less than 8 minutes. Cuts down on your TP use by 80%, saving money and paper waste. So, hey, be environmentally friendly and also modern with a Hello Tushy bidet. Hello Tushy has cleaned over 1 million happy bums. I want all of our listeners to have clean bums. That is, I wake up in the morning, I say that as my affirmation in the mirror. Does the Majority Report audience have a clean butt? That's my priority.
They relax a little bit on it, but, you know, you're strident.
No, I'm committed. Visit HelloTushy.com/majority to get 10% off plus free shipping right now. That's HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off, and tag at HelloTushy on social media so they can celebrate your clean bum with you. You're taking a butt shot on Instagram for your followers, looking good? Tag Hello Tushy so everybody and all of your dating prospects know that your butt is as clean as a whistle.
That wasn't even in the cup.
HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Donald Iacovone, author of Teaching White Supremacy, the Textbook Battle Over Race in American History. We are back, and we are joined now by Donald Iacovone, historian and associate at the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard University, whose book is entitled Teaching White Supremacy, the Textbook Battle Over Race in American History. Donald, thanks so much for coming on today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Actually, the title of the book was changed. You have an older version of the title.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No, that's all right. I've been at this for a very long time, and that was an original title. It's now America's Democratic Ordeal and the Forging of Our National Identity. That's the subtitle. The main title remains.
Okay, I completely apologize, but yes, we will update that and make sure that that's completely accurate in our show notes when we link to your book.
Okay.
So let's start off with really the premise of your book. You start with quoting James Baldwin, one of my all time favorite Americans,
yeah.
who says, "I was taught in American history books that Africa had no history and that neither had I." And that's just obviously just so profoundly true. And not much has changed since then. In fact, we're in the midst of a large political anti-critical race theory movement from the right. In an effort to cement erasure of Black history. Just talk about the genesis of the idea and how it's both present and all throughout our history.
It certainly is, and the problem, of course, remains embedded in the nature of American culture. There has been change. We don't want to deny the fact that there has been change. There's been significant change. Anyone who is my age can compare what, for instance, is on television compared to in the 1950s and 60s compared to what it is today. It's a different world. Back in the 1950s and 60s, no one would have ever suggested that an African-American could be president of the United States. That was just unheard of. And if you advocated it, your sanity would have been questioned. However, the election of an African-American president has unleashed a torrent of anxiety among that portion of American society, which retains this emphasis upon whiteness, which was born in ideas of whiteness and as not only one's personal identity, but as a national identity. And Jill Lepore, who teaches at Harvard and also writes for The New Yorker, wrote a book at the time of Obama's election, stating that his election to many Americans seemed to have torn a hole in the fabric of time. This is as profound as it gets. And I think the issues we are now facing, the crisis we have been facing now for several years, is indicative both of the progress we have made and the terrible anxiety that so many Americans feel. It is as if a tectonic plate underneath the surface of the earth is cracking and being washed away. Because so many Americans for so long have identified themselves and the nature and the nation with whiteness. Their very identities are formulated upon what is, in fact, a fiction. There are no such things as races. These are products of the late 18th and early 19th centuries. A hierarchy established based on nothing we would call science today, but based on observations and the purpose of which was to place people of European descent at the top of a hierarchy and people of African descent at the bottom.
And what your book does such an amazing job with is show how this wasn't just an ideology that was embedded in our learning methods and in our textbooks, which you do study, as written by Southerners, but that the definition of Americanism as whiteness, American equals white, is as foundational to the way that our population was educated as anything, and as it was essentially a project of like the people who were actually writing these books, Northern publishers and elites in some of the institutions like Harvard, where you're a part of. Yeah,
sure. Oh, absolutely. In fact, this is a major theme of the book. We modern Americans are accustomed to thinking of racial prejudice as a product of the history of the history of slavery in the South and of Southern resistance to integration. Well, and of course, that's all true, and one would not want to deny the horrific legacy of slavery and Jim Crow segregation in the South. It's true. It's very true. It's painfully true. However, the ideology of white supremacy is a Northern creation, it begins right at the beginning of the colonization of the colonies and continues right through to the present day. We had a society in which all the major aspects of our culture, whether we're talking about education, of course, religion, politics, and certainly the law, were all dominated by Northern-trained, usually Northern-born, but certainly Northern-trained scholars, ministers, and the like. And it, as I said, it begins right at the start. And one of the most symbolic, I think that's the right word, examples of this is Samuel Sewall, who's remembered today as being the judge of the Salem witchcraft trials. However, he was also the person who wrote the first anti-slavery pamphlet in American history. In 1700, he published The Selling of Joseph. Now, it was indicative that few people read it. And that is because, as he confessed in his pamphlet, that most of the colonists could not tolerate the idea of an African-American who was not a slave and was free and therefore approaching equality. It was an impossibility. And he described this impossibility as being a kind of what he called, quote, extravasant blood. That is blood that exists outside the regular veins and capillaries of the body. It is alien. It is an alien force. It is forever outside of white experience. In fact, this was so embedded in his own mind, even though he was an opponent of slavery, condemned slavery as unchristian, condemned the slave trade as horrific, yet in his diary, he wondered that upon his death, would he retain his whiteness, quote, after the resurrection?
Wow. I mean,
that's how deep and abiding this issue is in American culture.
And how do you connect that with sort of the combination of both historically and today, American identity with this sort of evangelism and religiosity of being, you know, Christian, but also in the way that people deify the founding fathers, for example? I would argue that is a extension of white supremacy thought and how deeply embedded that is. Like, how does religion intertwine with the kind of patriotic view of America that is also inextricably a white view?
Well, it all is based on who you include as being sort of God's constituency, if you will. If you do not consider people of non-European descent to be not fully human, then you can talk about the Garden of Eden. You can talk about all aspects of Christianity, and not for a second extend those thoughts, those beliefs, to people outside of what we call white society and culture. In fact, you know, the legacy is divided on this issue because you have many Christians in the ministers in the 19th century who were willing to accept people of African descent as human, but a lesser form of human. But then you have other people within Christianity who considered people of African descent to be a completely different species of human, designed by nature and God to do the white man's work. And this, of course, is the foundation of the ideology of John H. Van Every, who I spend the second chapter discussing, who again is so representative of American culture and the depth of belief in white supremacy, even if people don't necessarily accept individual aspects of his thought, but he is reflective of the depth of and centrality of white supremacy. In fact, it is to his mind, and this is something that Toni Morrison even wrote about, that the presence of Africans in American culture was a necessity for democracy to grow, and that we could not have white democracy without the African presence because of the presumed difference between the two that it proved to American colonists and then American citizens, that the differences among people of European descent, when of course Europe had a long history of it, had in fact there are more years of war within the European history than there are of peace. And at the time, democracy was not considered to be a legitimate and doable form of government. That's why you had all, royalty in Europe. But in the United States, once the colonists become the United States, democracy becomes possible because the what we would call the mudsill class is under control.
Mm.
And just to drive home this point, in 1954, the Harvard psychologist Gordon Allport wrote a still stunning book on the history of prejudice in the United States, and buried in this deep, like it's pretty thick study of American prejudice, buried deep in that is a story, because he did a lot of interviews to come up with this, with the theories, psychological theories of why prejudice was so central to American culture. He interviewed a 5-year-old white girl, and she expressed her sadness that a local black family who lived very close to where she lived was moving away. And Allport, I think, was kind of rather stunned to hear that this 5-year-old girl was upset that an African-American family was moving. Well, why? Well, now, she said, there is no one that we're better than.
Mm.
That's a direct quote.
Wow.
So even in a 5-year-old girl, the profound depth of white supremacy is already embedded. She's not even in kindergarten yet. She's not even in the education system. Yet the dominance of whiteness has already been imprinted on her.
I mean, your talk about how democracy I'm reminded of we've been talking about Israel Palestine. This is a bit of an aside on the show before. Mm-hmm. And John Kerry was criticized a few years ago for saying that you can't have a Jewish state and also for Israel to be democratic, because that's by its very nature excluding Palestinians from that voting process. And Right. It's quite a similar tension here that you talk about, because to make that point, to undercut the United States as a democratic city on a hill or as right. something that is aspirational as opposed yes. to fundamentally a founded on a white supremacist ideology that is exclusionary and therefore undemocratic, that mm-hmm. that does break the kind of religious orthodoxy that of American patriotism, which is also, of course, yeah. connected to white supremacy.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, at the same time, as I said at the beginning of this, there has been change.
Yeah.
There has been greater, far greater acceptance than has ever occurred in American culture. And, you know, if we could sort of place ourselves maybe 40 or 50 years in the future, we might see a long, gradual process in which this country begins. We can trace the decline of emphasis on white supremacy and the acceptance of a multiracial or a multicultural country. That's an optimistic view. We do seem to be moving in that direction. But history doesn't move in straight lines, and yeah. it zigs and zags. And right now we're going through a real zigzag process, which at times is clearly extremely upsetting and disturbing, especially when we have schools from all over the country that are still inculcating white supremacy in their students. There, I ran across, and I mentioned this in the last chapter of the book, more than mentioned, discussed it pretty thoroughly, where you have classrooms in which there are slave auctions. Now, this is Vermont, New Jersey, New York, the state of Washington, Florida. It's all over. Can you imagine what it would be like for a young African-American student, sixth grade, seventh grade, even fifth grade, to be forced, to be compelled to stand in front of their white classmates, to be auctioned off to the highest bidder, and then told that if they were to run away, they would be beaten. Now, in fact, there were investigations into some of these, and as you would well imagine, this has created damaging, quite a bit of damage on the victims of these activities. And when parents objected, they were told that this is part of the established curriculum. We have no choice. We have to do this. It's just astonishing. This isn't history. This is a sick version of Hollywood that's going on in classrooms.
And so, I mean, your scholarship on this, I mean, you studied thousands of textbooks from the 19th and 20th century to inform your book here. And
yes.
You mentioned that second chapter on John H. Van Avery. Yeah, he was a publisher in New York, and you make a really compelling case about his ideas being so significant in the way that white supremacy is conceived here in this country. Can you expand on him as a figure in your story?
Oh, yeah. Well, again, going back to this theme of Northern responsibility for creating the ideology of white supremacy. Well, he was Canadian born. You don't get any more Northern than that in North America. He became a physician and then for most of his life abandoned his career as a physician to become the nation's first professional racist. He created a publishing empire in the heart of Manhattan, published several books on one of them bearing the title of White Supremacy, numerous pamphlets, which were essentially excerpts from his many books, and two newspapers, one of which was shut down during the Civil War by the Lincoln administration because it verged on treason. And then he changed the name of it to the Caucasian. this is a fascinating gentleman who was a marketing genius. And for the 19th century, it is truly astonishing how he used marketing principles to promote white supremacy. For instance, he published these offers in newspapers around the country, even in the South, and especially after the Civil War. He offered that to anyone who could put together a number of subscriptions from his neighbors, totaling about $90, and send that in, that person would be rewarded with the nation's leading sewing machine. Now, if you think about this, it sounds
like a prize. No,
it is a prize for doing all this work in gaining subscriptions. But when you think about why a sewing machine, because it brings the family into this orbit. In 1 year alone, he ran 1,500 different advertisements in 1,500 different American newspapers. I did a lot of research trying to see what he was up to, and it was rare that I could find a newspaper that didn't have an advertisement for one of his books. And like Walt Whitman, he would even review his own books in the press to spread the word about his principles and ideas. And so he creates this empire in the heart of Manhattan. He continues through the Civil War. He continues. It grows even larger after the Civil War, where he takes on radical Reconstruction to convince the nation that this way it may seem contradictory at first, that we need African Americans. They are essential. They are essential because they are a lower species of humanity, designed by nature and God to do the white man's work. He denied the reality of slavery. He said slaves don't exist. He refused to use the term. This is after 1855. He refused to use the term because to him, slavery was an institution that occurred in white Europe. And that applied to humans enslaving, capturing other humans of the same ilk. But since people of African descent were a lower form of humanity, like he said, the eagle being a species of bird, an owl being a species of bird, but different. One he thought superior to the other. Eagle being obviously the superior in his mind, superior bird, and the owl being the inferior bird, but they're both birds. In the same way, he explained, you have the superior person of European descent, and then you have the inferior human designed by nature and God to do the white man's work. Now, the North, was largely dedicated, this is up to and a few years after the Civil War, to the American Colonization Society. Now, I think their desire was, yes, we don't want slaves, but we also don't want people of African descent living with us. If all people of African descent had lived in the South, there wouldn't have been an American Colonization Society in the North. Because there would have been no need as far as they were concerned. Van Every is a little bit different than the average when it comes to assessing the reality of black life in American culture. But in his mind, they were to do the white man's labor, and they would do that labor mostly in the South.
Well, he was diabolical seemingly and ahead of his time to a degree, yes. Because I like to bring these just to show how history is still present. The entirety of this anti-CRT push and the school board meetings and how that, getting parents activated on that front is also about bringing white supremacy into the family and making it a politically activating principle. And so you can see how that continues. I do want to talk a bit about, you mentioned Reconstruction there, how that changed things and how you were able to trace the way that race and slavery was discussed pre-Civil War, post, and then also this kind of more like the more positive framing of slavery in some of these textbooks at the turn of the century going into the 20s and 30s.
I want to make it clear that this is not a book about a bunch of bad books. this is an assessment of American culture and American identity. And the great thing about, which I discovered, entirely by chance, was that the textbooks, of course, embody American values, American principles. They not only trace the history of the nation, but what the culture is supposed to value and honor. It's glorious principles and the future it seeks to create. We could call them like prayer books in a way. And the fact that so many, the overwhelming majority of them placed the priority on whiteness. And I can't come up with a better example of this than one 1930 textbook, which on the very first page, right below chapter one, in capital letters, the history of the white man. Now, it can't be any more explicit than that. But it's not just a matter of what is said about African Americans in these textbooks. It's also what isn't said, how they are not included in the narrative of America. They are always exceptional, just like Samuel Sewall, extravascent blood outside the regular veins and capillaries of the body politic. And that's the way African Americans were presented throughout American history in the textbooks. So textbooks are evidence. I don't discuss them because they're textbooks. I treat them the same way I would treat a manuscript collection or newspapers or magazines. They offer the evidence, they have statements, and the lack of material for what is happening in the culture. And it's a convenient narrative that goes, and the collection I used was housed and is housed in the School of Education's library at Harvard. And there were 3,000 of these. And I cited 220 in this book. So I got a really good representative sampling of how Americans have conceived of themselves and the African-American role in American culture. And it is a horrific story which becomes even worse once African Americans become free. There's a brief interlude after the Civil War in which the principles of radical Reconstruction do get infused into the culture, and many textbooks are printed and are published again by Northern presses. They have the monopoly on all these things to inculcate principles of radical Reconstruction for racial equality and true democracy. I was really quite astonished to see the depth of commitment to true democracy in many of these textbooks, in particular by the one published by Charles Carlton Coffin, who was the North's most famous Civil War reporter. And he dedicated his career after the Civil War to writing the history of the United States, actually the history of liberty from its earliest days right through his own times. And these books were immensely popular during the latter part of the 19th century. In fact, the Boston Public Library had 45 copies of his book. All of them were perpetually out on loan. So he was popular. They included images of abolitionists. This was almost unheard of. In fact, the textbooks up until the Civil War didn't even discuss the abolitionist movement. But here they become heroic because they are committed to liberty and justice. And that persists from the 1870s to the 1880s, 1890s, at the same time that lost cause ideology is growing. So there is a kind of battle, thus the original title you had cited at the beginning of this. Well, because it was clear that there was strife over the future of the United States, and you could see it manifested in these textbooks. But by the early 20th century, after African Americans had enjoyed decades of freedom and were progressing, there's no question about it. African American culture was progressing. African Americans were succeeding. And that, turns out, was a threat to white supremacy. In fact, and I cite this in the first chapter, the more African Americans from the colonial period right through the 20th century, the more African Americans became like the people around them, emerging from slavery, you know, becoming citizens of a sort, becoming economically successful, going to college, W.E.D. Du Bois. My God, these people were brilliant. The more that happened, the more people of white or European descent reacted in horror and fear. Thus, the prejudice increases because African Americans are becoming more successful. And to keep them in their place, you needed more suppression. And thus, the textbooks became even more outrageous in their denunciation of Black culture. And textbook after textbook, and we're talking about the 1940s and 1950s, and right into the 1960s, denying that African Americans could even learn. John D. Hicks, who was a extremely popular and successful historian at University of California, Berkeley, belittled what he called the African American quest for education. What? They want to be educated, and that is a pathetic quest in your mind. And this is in his own textbooks he's writing. This is in personal correspondence. This is what he is teaching.
And so that is what, I mean, to kind of bring this all home, that's what makes it so, I mean, well, actually, I have another question, I guess, about really briefly, too, about the lost cause myth being embedded in some of these textbooks as well. Do you mind touching on that?
Oh, well, no. We are accustomed to thinking about lost cause ideology as what it was, of course, a Southern reaction to the Civil War and the defeat in the Civil War. And we have a situation where, yes, they lost the military aspect of the war, but won the peace. And it was expressed through this lost cause ideology, the glory of the South, and the heroism of Robert E. Lee, et cetera, all because of mistaken notion in the North about the poor African-American, when in fact slave master treated their slaves so well, pampered them. And one of the books I read even said that George Washington was the typical slave owner who gave his slaves broth, sweetened tea, and even, quote, a little wine. That is the image of slavery that became perpetuated to defend the South and its principles of black suppression. Well, the first expressions of this lost cause ideology was in the North, not the South. John H. Van Every, who is, you know, as I had said before, the first professional racist, wrote a textbook along with his business partner, Rushmore G. Horton, whose name is actually on it, to propagate these ideas that slaves were forced from their plantations by Union troops because they did not want to be, quote, free. They loved being on the plantation, serving their white masters. And it took Union soldiers at bayonet point to force them off their plantations into, quote, freedom, unquote. And Abraham Lincoln was a dupe of the British royalty who was behind the Civil War to emancipate slaves and destroy American democracy. That's what was behind the conflict. His textbook was read and swallowed whole by Edward Pollard, who wrote the book, The Lost Cause, who was famous because of that. He read Van Every, and he had been a defender of slavery, but after reading Van Every, he realized, he said, that these people weren't slaves. We don't defend slavery. We are simply, quote, defending an inferior people, giving them Christianity, giving them trades and tools, and, quote, education, unquote. The way the African presence in the South from the beginning was a Christian mission to save or rescue people of African descent from an abysmal swamp of ignorance, what they referred to it. So this is turning history inside out, but it isn't simply a Southern manifestation. It is a national manifestation, and the ideology is Northern. White supremacy grows up along with slavery. Slavery was a North American phenomenon, not a strictly Southern one. And the first laws to preserve and legalize slavery was formed in Massachusetts in 1641.
And not to cut you off, but yeah, the other thing, you know, you write about is Harvard was studying eugenics, promoting those kinds of theories. The Dunning School, I believe, came out of one of the Ivies.
Columbia.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. The intellectual origins, yes, intellectual right. origins yes. of the, this are paved into like the most esteemed institutions in the North.
Absolutely. And the publishing industry was for the most part, a Northern phenomenon. And the overwhelming number of textbooks from the beginning in 1800 right through the 1980s and really to the present were published not in San Antonio, not in Charleston, but Boston, New York, Chicago. Absolutely. It's a Northern bound phenomenon, created, dominated, not Southern. So, you know, after doing all the research for this and writing the book, it came clear to me that if we are ever to solve the problems that we are facing and facing in increasing levels today, we must recognize national responsibility, not sectional responsibility for this issue.
Well, that's a wonderful note to leave us off on here. Donald Iacovone, historian and associate at the Hutchins Center for African and African American Research at Harvard University. And the book is Teaching White Supremacy, America's Democratic Ordeal and the Forging of Our National Identity. Yeah. Thank you so much for your time today, Donald. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, well, no, thank you.
All right. With that said, we are going to wrap up the free hour of this program. We'll be heading into the fun half. We'll be doing some clips, taking your calls, reading your IMs. But first, Matt, what is happening on Left Reckoning?
Oh, yeah. We did. We released a bunch of content over the weekend, actually. For everybody, Asal Rad, research director at the National Iranian American Council, or I think that's what NIAC stands for. I'm talking about these protests in Iran and how to not react to them stupidly and callously. and also we did a, for Patreons, patreon.com/leftreckoning, a conversation on the anatomy of the microsect and how we go from splintering into sects into actually forming a movement on the left. That's an essay by Hal Draper from 1973. So patreon.com/leftreckoning to hear David and I talk about that.
And on ESVN today, we will be live at 4 p.m. We will be recapping the NFL weekend, including the Giants are 3-1 and the Jets are 2-2. I mean, this is really a great time for Bradley and I to be doing the show because this is the best start both of our teams have been on since for the Giants. It's literally at least a decade. The Jets, what, more?
Yes, more.
Your mic's on down. Yes, more. Okay. So we'll be diving into that, but we also will have our first guest on the show. I'm very excited to have my friend Greg Kaplan of Blue Shirts Breakaway on to preview the NHL season, but he's also, despite having the top Rangers podcast and one of the top hockey podcasts in the country, he is probably a bigger Mets fan than he is a Rangers fan, so he's going to talk about the Major League Baseball playoffs, preview it. And I don't want to speak for Greg, but I would imagine he's going to have some sort of meltdown about how the Mets just completely shit the bed over the weekend.
Yeah, tune in for me to scream about that
and Bradley too
before I go to the game tonight.
Yeah,
that's smart to make your main sort of focus professionally your second favorite sports team, because I feel like making it your favorite would lead to be mentally unwell.
I mean, he's such a dogmatic Mets fan that I think that is probably some of his thinking. So check that out. He'll have some good rants for you guys here on the Majority Report channel, but then also just download us on podcasts and podcast platforms like Apple and Spotify. Rate us 5 stars and subscribe to youtube.com/ESVN show for clips, and eventually our content's going to be migrating over there. So check us out. All right, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone?
Nomi Keene.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello? Is
single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for a walk.
Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501.
One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
You call it satire. Sam goes, satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.